with the North Carolina Reading Service, and it is Saturday, May 10th, and now it's time for the readings of the News and Observer. Today's broadcast of articles and information from the News and Observer is read exactly as printed. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Your readers are Lisa Maxwell
and Mary Ellen Sura.
And we are going to begin the broadcast with Mary Ellen giving you the TV listings for this Saturday evening.
I am going to read the listings from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. unless something happens to start earlier. First up, ABC. At 8 o'clock, it's the NBA Countdown Live. At 8:30, the NBA Basketball, Minnesota Timberwolves at Golden State Warriors, Western Conference Semifinal, Game 3. On CBS, at 8 o'clock, FBI International. 9 o'clock and 10 o'clock, there are episodes of 48 Hours. On Fox, Major League Baseball, Chicago Cubs at the New York Mets starts at 7, and then at 10 o'clock, the WRAL 10 p.m. news. On NBC, at 8 o'clock, it's Yes, Chef. At 9, Dateline NBC, and at 10, Saturday Night Live with Quinta Brunson and Benson Boone. This was a broadcast from May 3rd. On ION, NWSL Soccer, Orlando Pride at the North Carolina Courage starts at 7:30. There's a pregame show at 7 on ION. And then after the match, at 9:30, the match break show. And at 10, another game, the Portland Thorns Football Club at San Diego Wave Football Club. PBS Saturday is Mystery Night. We've got Midsummer Murders, The Green Man Part 1 at 8, The Green Man Part 2 at 9, and Death in Paradise at 10. On MNT. At 8 o'clock, it's Chicago Fire. And then at 9 and 10, the first 48, two different episodes. On the CW, at 8 o'clock, a movie called I Am Johnny Cash from 2015. At 10, Last Man Standing. On A&E, it is a night of Storage Wars, half-hour episodes going from 7 to 11. On AMC, the movie, one of my favorites, My Cousin Vinny, with Marissa Tomei, Ralph Macchio, and Joe Pesci. On BET, at 8 o'clock, the movie Girls Trip, with Queen Latifah and Jada Pinkett. On the Disney Channel, starting at 7, Raya and the Last Dragon. That goes until 8:50. At 8:50, we've got episodes of Ladybug. There's another at 9:15, Ladybug. At 9:40 and 10:05, there are episodes of Kiff. On the Discovery Channel, Expedition Unknown, Mysteries of Moses at 8. 9 o'clock, Chasing the Mysteries of Moses on Expedition, and at 10, Identity Crises on Expedition. On ESPN, UFC 315, Muhammad versus Della Maddalena, the prelims, that is at 8 o'clock, and then at 10, Boxing, Emmanuel Navarrete versus Charlie Suarez. On TNT, starting at 6 o'clock, there is the hockey game, the Washington Capitals at the Carolina Hurricanes. That's live starting at 6. This is the whatever. I know they're in the conference rounds. In national, and then at 9 o'clock, it's the Vegas Golden Knights at the Edmonton Oilers live. That's game 3 in the Western Conference, second round. And finally, on USA, We have the AMA Supercross Series Round 17 from Salt Lake City. That starts at 7, and then at 10 o'clock, the movie Any Given Sunday with Al Pacino.
And now it's time for this morning's announcements. You are listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, connecting people who are blind and print impaired to each other, their families, and communities by delivering news, information, and entertainment using the latest audio technology. In addition to using specially tuned sub-channel radio receivers, NCRS streams our programming on our website at ncreadingservice.org. Listen by using the Listen Live streaming audio player located at the upper right-hand corner of our website pages. If you have an assistive technology device, such as Alexa or Google Home, just say, tune in NC Reading Service to listen instantly. We also provide podcasts of over 50 magazines. My apologies. A podcast of over 50 magazines and other information and entertainment programs following the initial broadcast. Please visit our website, ncreadingservice.org, and click on Skip to Podcast section. For more information about the North Carolina Reading Service, please call us at 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Have you gotten your free currency reader yet? The Department of the Treasury's Bureau of Engraving and Printing is now providing a free currency reader to all eligible blind or visually impaired individuals. The device is small, compact, and runs on a AAA battery, which is included. To use the currency reader, simply insert a U.S. bill into the reader and press the button. The device will tell the note's denomination. To request your currency reader, fill out an application form, which is available to download at www.bep.gov. It must be signed by a competent authority, such as a doctor, who can certify your eligibility. Then simply mail it to the address on the application. Once your application is verified, a reader will be mailed to you at no charge. For more information about the U.S. Currency Reader Program, visit www.bep.gov. Or you can also call toll-free 844-815-9388. And now I've got some information for you about some local plays which offer audio description. Now in Raleigh, and this will be tomorrow, Sunday, May 11th, we have Schoolhouse Rock Live at 3 p.m., and this will be at the Raleigh Little Theater, which is at 301 Pogue Street in Raleigh. The number you can call, again, my apologies, you may call 919-821-3111, and you can get a free ticket for your driver, so be sure that you ask for that. Now, in Greensboro, there are a couple of plays that are this weekend, one being today, May 10th at 2 o'clock, Back to the Future. And on Sunday, May the 11th, Back to the Future is playing again at 1 o'clock. And these are at the Tanger Center, 300 North Elm Street in Greensboro. My apologies. And now I've got some information for you from the Disability Rights of North Carolina. Our work is threatened. Can we count on you so our community can continue to count on us? Did you know this year marks the 50th anniversary of the Protection and Advocacy Network? as North Carolina's designated PNA, Disability Rights North Carolina has proudly carried out our federally mandated mission, protecting and advocating for the rights of people with disabilities across our state. Funding cuts threaten the services and protections we provide to individuals with disabilities and those who love and care for them. This isn't just a budget line. This is about real people losing access to education, health care, safe housing, and the support they need to live with dignity. To find out how you can help, go to disabilityrightsnc.org/takeaction. And that is it for this morning's announcements. And we are going to go back to Mary Ellen, and she will give you the weather and our first front page article.
All right. So it looks like it's going to be a beautiful day today. Less humid with high clouds. A high of 74, the real feel is going to be feeling like a high of 80. The UV index is 11, so please put on your sunscreen. Tonight, it will be partly cloudy. We've got the low of 58, the real feel of 59. Sunday, Mother's Day, occasional rain, mainly early, with a high of 67 and a low of 60. Because of the rain, the real feel is going to be a high of 75 and a low of 56. The UV index will be 9. On Monday, a shower and thunderstorm in the PM. The high will be 73, the low 67, a UV index of only 3. Our first article today: NC chipmaker says bankruptcy possible as it faces looming debt. Executives of the struggling Durham semiconductor firm Wolfspeed said they are exploring in-court or out-of-court options to address the company's approaching debt obligations. "We remained actively engaged with our lenders addressing our capital structure," board chairman Tom Werner said during a first quarter earnings call on Thursday. Wolfspeed owes creditors $575 million in convertible debt on May 1, 2026, with more money due in 2028, 29, and 30. The company ended March with $1.3 billion in cash, and Werner said Wolfspeed has the liquidity to operate in the short term. Werner discussed Wolfspeed's aggressive cost cutting, including shrinking its 5,000-person workforce by a quarter since last year through buyouts and mass layoffs. As a further step, he announced Wolfspeed would cut 30% of its senior leadership team. The chipmaker is also shutting its 150-millimeter device factory in Durham. "We've engaged external experts to continue to identify additional cost-saving measures beyond those already underway," Werner said. Whether this will be enough to stave off bankruptcy remains unclear. The looming debt issue appears to have scared analysts, several of whom downgraded the company Friday. The investment firm William Blair even suspended its coverage of Wolfspeed, noting bankruptcy and Wolfspeed's ability to restructure its debt as risks. Wolfspeed stock fell 26% Friday after it forecast lower than expected revenue for next year, $850 million against analysts' expectations of more than $950 million. The sell-off may also have been prompted by the company publishing financial information it had previously provided to debt holders, which signaled the failure of one potential restructuring deal. Wolfspeed has issued more than $3 billion in convertible bonds in recent years to fund its transformation from traditional LED lighting operations toward exclusively manufacturing a unique type of semiconductor called silicon carbide. This material is used in electric vehicles, power systems, defense equipment, and other applications. In 2022, the company opened a new chip fabrication facility in New York State's Mohawk Valley and a massive silicon carbide materials plant near Siler City in western Chatham County, which Wolfspeed expects to open this summer. Wolfspeed began last summer with more than 5,000 employees worldwide, financial records show. Most were based in North Carolina, where the company was Durham County's fifth largest employer. Over the past 6 months, the chipmaker has also shaken up its executive team. Thursday's earnings call was the first attended by new CEO Robert Furl and the last one for outgoing Chief Financial Officer Neil Reynolds. "One thing is abundantly clear," Furl said. "Wolfspeed is a company with enormous potential underpinned by strong foundational elements already in place." The company did not take analysts' questions during the earnings call. While some creditors have offered the company a deal to restructure its debt obligations, Wolfspeed leaders indicate that they want a broader answer as they contemplate a strategic in-court transaction. In an email Friday, Wolfspeed head of investor relations Tyler Gronbach said the in-court language conveyed the company's belief that it will likely need a comprehensive solution to strengthen our balance sheet over the next 12 months.
And the next article I have for you, lawmakers still hopeful on bills to ban hemp sales to minors. Lawmakers in North Carolina haven't fully decided how to regulate hemp, including when it comes to keeping it out of the hands of minors. This session, Republicans and Democrats in both chambers have together filed more than a dozen bills dealing with either marijuana or hemp. Both come from the cannabis plant, but while hemp is legal in the state, marijuana is not. Marijuana-related bills this year so far have all come from Democrats. Bills dealing with hemp and other cannabis derivatives, however, have come from both parties, with GOP-led proposals to prohibit the sale of hemp products to anyone under 21. That includes oils, gummies, and other products often packaged in vibrant designs that might attract children. Marijuana's key psychoactive component, Delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC, delivers what's typically associated with the drug's high. Hemp is defined as cannabis with less than 0.3% Delta-9 THC, and there are no age limits under state or federal law on buying or using hemp products. Other compounds in cannabis, often found in hemp, can also cause a high, including Delta-8 THC. State Republicans filed one proposal, Senate Bill 265, while House Republicans introduced two others. House Bill 607 has largely the same language as the Senate bill, while House Bill 680 omits provisions to limit packaging appealing to minors, product testing requirements, and manufacturer or distributor licensing. It also sets lower fines. All three require sellers to be licensed. But all share the same goal, keeping hemp and its derived products away from minors and tightening industry rules. Republicans control both chambers and largely decide which bills move forward. None of the three bills has received a committee hearing. All missed the Thursday crossover deadline when most bills must pass one chamber to stay alive. But they're not dead. Even if bills don't advance ahead of the deadline, lawmakers in the majority often find ways to advance their priorities, like amending another bill to add the legislation. These hemp bills have fees in them, which meant they weren't subject to the deadline, said Representative Timothy Reeder, a Republican and emergency physician from Aiden, who is a primary sponsor of House Bill 680. I'm hopeful, and I've talked to a lot of the other bill sponsors. I'm hopeful that we're going to be able to come together to consolidate a lot of the bills into something that will get a committee hearing and move through the process, Reeder said. This week saw a flurry of votes on bills on various topics. A lot of things we're just trying to get through, and I think this is a complicated one with a lot of different moving parts, and we just didn't have enough time to get everybody together to come up with what we thought would be a good policy that we could advance through the legislature, he said. He said lawmakers have differences on the regulatory framework, but general agreement that limiting access for those under 21 is important. While he wouldn't name specific regulations causing sticking points, Reeder said it came down to the balance of government, bureaucracy, enforcement authority, and managing the issue. Reeder said the House is currently focused on the budget, and once that's done, there should be more time to deal with hemp. He added that he was hopeful that conversations could begin in the next week or two. There are kids who are being injured by these products, not just kids, but adults as well. And so protecting children under 21 is very important to me, he said. It's not the first year that bills to prohibit hemp for minors have been filed. In the 2024 North Carolina legislative session, several bills were also introduced to regulate hemp-derived products, including House Bill 563 and Senate Bill 521. Both failed to pass. The former died in the House after the Senate linked the proposed legalization of medical marijuana to it. Bill Rabin, a Southport Republican, is the Senate Rules Committee chair, meaning he holds sway over what bills head to the floor. Despite his powerful role, he has filed bills for multiple years seeking to legalize medical marijuana in the state without success. While the Senate has okayed his bills, the House has not had the votes to support them. When asked about past attempts by the Senate to pass medical marijuana legalization along hemp regulations, Reeder said legalizing marijuana had not come up in his conversations, and that he hoped discussions about it wouldn't prevent us from doing good policy related to the intoxicating cannabinoids. He added that he himself would not support medical marijuana legalization as he did not see it as valid medicine at this time. While the Senate Rules Chairman supports legalizing medical marijuana, the House Rules Chairman, whose committee is holding the two House bills, works in the hemp industry and says he backs regulation. Representative John Bell has served as president of Esteril Labs, a Nashville-based CBD and hemp company, since 2023. CBD, or cannabidiol, is derived from hemp. The company sells THC products, including vapes, gummies, and pre-rolls, and says its website that it follows U.S. Food and Drug Administration manufacturing standards at its 10,000-square-foot triangle facility. Bell said the details of what a final bill might look like were better left to the sponsors, but added that he was supportive of seeing regulations in the hemp and CBD industry. I would support making sure that the good actors stay in the industry and the bad actors are out, he said. Bell said understanding of the industry has shifted quickly. I mean, shoot, 2 years ago, I knew very little about it, and I found myself running a premier CBD and hemp company here in North Carolina. And so those things change over time, he said. But there's been big discussion with law enforcement on age restrictions and how we navigate this and the challenges they're facing. So I know that's a big concern by members and something we'd like to address. He added that packaging restrictions are another area that's being discussed. While any time you add regulations and fees, it's going to have an impact on business, Bell said. I'm for regulations. I'm for taxation of the industry. If done right, we can have a very safe and regulated industry that could be good not only for consumers, but also good for business, he said. Smaller businesses tend to experience a greater burden from regulations. Bell said his company does not sell to anyone under 21 and takes self-regulation seriously. As for what top leaders think, they're noncommittal on whether bills will pass. Senate leader Phil Berger told the News and Observer on Wednesday, after the Senate finished its work of advancing bills before the deadline, that our expectation was the House was going to send something over to us and we'll be able to work with that in terms of putting the Senate stamp on it. House Speaker Dustin Hall, meanwhile, said the issue hasn't so far gotten much attention within his caucus. While aware of bills aimed at restricting hemp sales to minors, he said it really hasn't been that big of a discussion among folks. He said concerns exist over what's being sold in some stores, including products from China or with unclear ingredients, and that lawmakers may need to address the issue eventually, but I don't know that anything's imminent yet. At some point, I imagine you'll see us move something on it in the future, he said. And now we will go to Mary Ellen with our next article.
Okay, this one's also kind of weather forecast related. Will rain and storms affect your Mother's Day plans? Weather-wise, Mother's Day in Raleigh and the Triangle will be a partly cloudy break between the downpours that came at the end of this week and the ones coming next week. The wet, relatively cool weather is thanks to a cold front expected to move across North Carolina Friday evening, May 9th, followed by two areas of high pressure coming from the Midwest over the weekend and a low pressure system moving into the state next week. Here's the forecast. Showers are possible Sunday morning in Raleigh and again in the afternoon, according to the AccuWeather forecast. In between, the National Weather Service suggests that there will be a rain-free window to visit with Mom and get seated at her favorite restaurant for lunch. The high on Sunday is expected to be around 73 degrees, about 5 degrees cooler than average for the date. The chance of rain increases beginning Sunday night, with up to 1.9 inches of rainfall possible by Monday night in parts of central North Carolina. The heaviest rainfall is likely to be south of Raleigh, the Weather Service says. Showers and thunderstorms are likely again Tuesday through Tuesday night, with the heaviest rainfall shifting to the east of Raleigh. Rain could be heavy enough Monday and Tuesday to cause flash flooding in low-lying and urban areas. Wednesday's forecast is a bit more iffy, forecasters say. As of Friday, May 9th, it looks like Wednesday will bring rain, but not as heavy as the first 2 days of the week. Thursday's forecast shows mostly sunny conditions and a high of nearly 86. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Climate Prediction Center forecast shows drought persisting in parts of North Carolina through May, but improving this summer. By July 31st, the Climate Prediction Center says, the parts of the state that are now abnormally dry or in drought should be back to normal. That's because North Carolina is expected to see above normal amounts of rain through the period. And now we'll go back to Lisa.
All of our Cary residents would be interested in this article. Cary residents could see property tax increase. Cary homeowners would pay higher taxes under a proposed town budget that seeks to fund the town's needs while responding to the pressures of inflation. Town manager Sean Stiegel said the town's finances are strong in the face of economic uncertainty and that his $508 million budget reflects the realities of an aging community. Cary's influx subsidy era is over, he explained, referring to the period following fast population growth when new residents' tax contributions help keep tax rates low while expanding services. Cary's population, at over 190,000 residents, is the second largest in Wake County, but growth has slowed, putting more pressure on the tax rate, Stiegel says. The budget proposes a 1.5 cent property tax rate increase, bringing it to 34 cents per $100 of assessed property value. The owners of a $550,000 home, the median value in Cary as of February, would see a town tax bill of $1,870. The current year's $503.5 million budget prioritized affordable housing, the environment, parks, and public safety. The tax rate dropped to 32.4 cents, but many homeowners paid higher tax bills due to Wake County's property revaluation, which raised residential property values by an average of 57% and commercial properties by 39%. Also, last year, Cary voters rejected a $560 million parks bond that would have raised property taxes further. Mayor Harold Weinbrech noted in a blog post the budget has no new hires in Cary for the second year in a row. Wake County Manager David Ellis presented the county's $2 billion budget this week, proposing a 0.25 cent per $100 valuation tax rate increase to help pay for the $142 million library bond that voters approved in November. If both Cary's and the county's budgets are approved with their proposed tax rates, the owner of a $550,000 house in Cary would get a combined tax bill of $4,708. The proposed budget recommends $80.7 million for public safety, with $44 million of that for the Cary Police Department. The town expects to borrow $2.8 million this fall to buy a police mobile command center and an armored response vehicle. The Cary Fire Department will get $33 million and will soon get new fire trucks. Over $16 million is recommended for the Parks and Recreation Department, which includes community recreation centers and programs, sports venues like the Wake Med Soccer Park, and the Outdoor Environmental Division. Had last year's parks bond been approved, the town would have added three community centers and one senior center. The largest chunk of the money would have gone to a $300 million sports and recreation center. Residents can share comments about the budget by calling 311 or 919-469-4000 or speaking at any upcoming Cary Town Council meeting. Public hearings on the budget are scheduled for May 22nd and June 16th. Residents can also text TXT 1-800-311-311 or directly message the town on social media to share comments. The budget is set to be adopted at the end of June and take effect July 1st. It also includes a 4% utility increase and a $2 increase to solid waste fees, bringing the amount to $25 a month. And Mary Ellen will read our next article.
Students accused of using deep fakes to cyberbully. Students at a Raleigh high school face disciplinary action as well as potential criminal charges for sharing offensive computer-generated images of a classmate to cyberbully the student. In messages sent Wednesday to families and students at Leesville Road High School, Principal Shawana Jacobs said some students created and shared artificial intelligence-generated, inappropriate images of another student on social media and spread false rumors about them. Jacobs said those actions also led to the circulation of hoax threats related to the images. It triggered an investigation by the Wake County School System's Security Department that determined the threats and posts were unsubstantiated and not credible. Still, spreading this kind of harmful content has real consequences, Jacobs said in the letter to students. Sending threatening messages, sharing threatening messages, or starting a rumor that incites fear, or even sharing a rumor that incites fear, are all serious offenses that could result in disciplinary action and criminal charges. Citing privacy laws, Wake said it could not provide details of the offensive and inappropriate images. The district also did not provide any details about the victims, such as age, gender, race, or grade. The incident at Leesville reflects a disturbing national trend of students using AI to generate deepfake images to harass and bully other students. The students will face consequences for their actions. Jacobs said the school immediately identified the students involved and contacted them and their parents. Federal student privacy laws prohibit us from sharing individual student information, Jacobs wrote in the message to parents. However, I want to be clear that anything that causes a disruption to the school environment can result in disciplinary action. A district spokesperson confirmed Thursday that disciplinary action is being taken against the students. The spokesperson also said that law enforcement is involved through the school resource officer. I also want to be very clear. Cyberbullying will not be tolerated, Jacobs wrote in her letter to students. Using technology to hurt, embarrass, or threaten others is harmful and goes against district policy. The principal asked students to not make threatening statements or start or share rumors that perpetuate fear among other students. Instead, Jacobs said students should share their concerns with school administrators or other school officials or use the district's anonymous tip line, 919-856-1911. A recent NC State University graduate has been accused of manufacturing and sharing computer-generated porn of dozens of sorority women, the News and Observer previously reported. Similar incidents across the country involved middle school and high school students generating deepfakes of other students. A national survey of more than 1,100 teachers, principals, and district leaders conducted in September by the EdWeek Research Center showed that 67% of them believed that their students had been misled by a deepfake. A national survey by the Center for Democracy and Technology showed that 40% of high school students were aware of a deepfake associated with someone they know at school. I think it's important for us to realize that one photo, just one posted online, is all that is needed in the age of AI to create a deepfake. And so this is an issue that could potentially impact nearly every student, Laura Tierney, the CEO and founder of the Social Institute, said in an interview on Thursday with the NNO. The Durham-based Social Institute works to teach social media skills to students, including how to spot AI deepfakes. Concerns about minors using social media led the State House to pass a bill this week that bans social media accounts for kids under 14. The House also passed a bill this week that requires school districts to teach students social media literacy skills. The legislation would also ban the use of TikTok on school district devices. Concerns about the harms caused by social media have led the State House and Senate to both pass bills this session requiring schools to restrict the use of cell phones during instructional time. Schools should be expected to teach social media literacy to students as they do now with driver's education, according to Tierney. When you are giving a child access to communicate with different people and to post things about themselves that can impact their reputation, Tierney said, education is crucial to make sure they're prepared to use that tool. So I think of those bills on social media education as the new driver's ed, and it's about time. All right, Lisa?
And our next article is titled, City Hauls Away Scrap Creation After Neighbors' Complaints. For at least a decade, the house at 1602 Oakwood Avenue stood surrounded by an 8-foot wall of white lattice hung with antique mirrors, a rainbow pinwheel, a Batman cape, and a choir of ceramic angels, all daring anyone to ignore the spectacle. Depending on your taste, the Southeast Raleigh landmark qualified either as the world's most eccentric trinket collection or a prize-winning pile of junk. On special mornings, you'd see the artist himself sweeping the sidewalk out front while curious commuters drove past, startled out of their ordinary Tuesdays. But on the Friday before last, the city ruled decisively in favor of the junk faction, hauling it all away as a public nuisance. The scrapyard art creation had drawn 3 complaints in the last 6 months, and it blocked the sidewalk, having at least partially collapsed. City spokeswoman Julia Milstead said Raleigh offered chances to move some of the stuff. At the end of the day, she said, this boiled down to a safety issue. But neighbors on the streets around St. Augustine's University see a sinister lack of tolerance and willingness to coexist in a part of Raleigh that has seen the old and crumbling rapidly replaced by the new and expensive. As the wall at 1602 Oakwood grew higher, adding a carousel horse and a Starbucks umbrella, a steady migration of newcomers arrived in far larger houses, sparking a tear-down trend that ruffles the old-timers' feathers. Having participated in this migration, albeit 20 years ago, I stand as a witness to how quickly the definition of eyesore can change. So around the Oakwood Avenue house, the faithful lament a familiar loss of character. Rest in peace to a true Raleigh landmark, said a disappointed fan, Swanson the Canal, on an Instagram post from Raleigh downtown. This is what it is to watch a living city die. And don't move in a historical neighborhood and demand that its quirkiness leave, echoed a post from Nail Yeah, a salon down nearby Hill Street. The city hasn't been concerned about the neighborhood until this new wave of people started moving in. I knocked on the door at 1602 Oakwood 4 times last week and never got an answer, even though the occupant and artist were clearly at home to hear the knocking. I'm guessing he didn't feel like speaking to anybody else wearing an ID badge on a lanyard. So I walked around the corner onto Hill Street and found Ken Evans, who owns and operates a business called Ken's Smell Goods and Fashion Wear. As you might guess, Evan sells both fragrances and secondhand clothing. Before he operated this store, he drove a truck for Macy's, and he would buy all the damaged boxes of clothes at a discount. "Nobody in this neighborhood cares," he told me, "if a North Face jacket or a pair of Nikes comes in a banged-up box." As to the junk art around the corner, he and his longtime neighbors are steaming. "Blocking the sidewalk? Then they should have pushed it," Evan said. "It looked like Fred Sanford over there. That's how I told people to find my store." People complained? "Maybe one or two complained," he said, "but that don't trump the whole neighborhood. That don't trump what's been there 20 years. He had stuff you and I can't get no more. Captain America, Superman, big wheels. I told him, 'You got the last big wheel.' Members only jackets. I told him, 'You're the last member.'" As a migrant myself, I deeply understand the appeal of life around downtown, restaurants and bars in walking distance, historic houses with plaques out front, neighbors that vary by age, race, income, status, and tendency to tell long stories while you've got an armful of groceries. But this place isn't for everybody. A lot of people around here drive rusted pickup trucks with junk in the back, and they might park them near your house. On some evenings, a stranger might knock on your door and tell you he's homeless, then offer to weed your garden for cash. Inconceivable as it may sound, I've seen people hang their wash on a clothesline. Honestly, I can recall a few moments when I thought of ratting somebody out on C-Click-Fix, or even worse, that gathering of paranoid outrage addicts who inhabit next door. But I always stop myself, not wanting to be that guy, not wanting to live on that street. All right, and Mary Ellen, we'll have our next article.
Plans to widen Aviation Parkway in Morrisville resurrected. Aviation Parkway, the mostly two-lane road that connects Interstate 40 with the heart of Morrisville, has changed little since the town was a rural crossroads with a couple hundred residents. Now Morrisville is a fast-growing suburb of more than 32,000, and the state is dusting off a stalled project to widen Aviation Parkway. The NC Department of Transportation will present plans to expand the road to four lanes at a public meeting at Morrisville Town Hall on Monday evening. NCDOT will overhaul 2.4 miles of Aviation Parkway between I-40 and NC 54 Chapel Hill Road. It plans to separate the two sides of the road with turn lanes or a grassy median, with a 5-foot-wide sidewalk on the north side and a 10-foot multi-use path on the south. Where Aviation Parkway crosses Lake Crabtree, the median will become narrower, replaced by wider paved shoulders. The causeway over the lake will need to be widened to make room for the wider road, which will include a multi-use path separated by a guardrail. NCDOT also plans to reconfigure the intersection of Aviation and NC 54 to eliminate left turns. Drivers wishing to turn left onto either road will use a new loop road in the northwest corner of the intersection, which will have traffic lights at both ends. Without left turns, traffic should flow more smoothly, with fewer crashes, particularly when the roads are busy, according to NCDOT's engineers. Planning for the Aviation Parkway project goes back to 2015. NCDOT had drafted initial designs and done environmental studies before presenting the results at a public meeting in June of 2019. But then NCDOT ran into financial problems that forced it to delay dozens of projects statewide, including Aviation Parkway. Planning work resumed in 2023. Completion is still a ways off, though. NCDOT expects to begin acquiring right-of-way next year, but not begin construction until the summer of 2029. Inflation, especially acute in the construction business, has driven up the cost. In 2019, NCDOT expected to spend $28.8 million on the project. Now, the estimate is more than $57 million. Monday's open house will take place from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Morrisville Town Hall, 100 Town Hall Drive. There will be no formal presentation, and people are free to come and go as they wish. For more information or to comment on NCDOT's plans, go to publicinput.com/4203.
And this next article is for those of you who may love American Idol. Charlotte King shares what's next after competing on Idol. Only a couple of episodes are left until someone takes the coveted title as the next American Idol. But that whirlwind journey is over for Charlotte's Josh King. This season began with nearly 150 aspiring artists who got a ticket to Hollywood after auditions. Week after week, the local singer and musician continue to rise above the rest of the competition, making it all the way to top eight. But in an unfortunate twist of irony, his last performance to one of his favorite songs, Home by Michael Bublé, brought him back home in the judges' song contest in the last episode, which had fans praising him as a class act for urging judges to save contestant Maddie Pruitt before he was eliminated. At the beginning of the competition, Charlotte 5 chatted with Josh King about his musical background that got him on the show. Now we're continuing the conversation about his overall experience and what's next for his music career. So I want to share some of those answers and questions with you. C5. A few times you seemed surprised to make it to the next round. What was going through your mind at the end when you were in the bottom two? Josh, there were like a couple things running through my head, like, okay, you know there's a chance they could save me again, but you know I doubt they would. At that point, I was kind of a bit sick of Hollywood, and I'm like, you know what? I think Maddie could really benefit from being on the show longer than I could. Because up to that point, there was like a list of accomplishments I wanted to kind of get on the show, like experience and things I want to do on the show, and I pretty much got all of that done pretty early on. I got to sing the songs I wanted to sing. I got to meet the people I wanted to meet. I got to get the experience I wanted. I got the challenges I wanted to complete. I was able to meet my goals, and I feel that Maddie Pruitt has a lot of room to grow and that she could benefit more from just continuing on, whereas I was okay with going home at that point. C5, what was your favorite performance and why? Josh, it depends on what type of performance style because I don't really pick favorites. All by myself was like the first time I really got to open up, so in a way, that was my favorite. I was able to really internalize the song well. It wasn't my best vocal performance. I wouldn't say that, but it was the performance where I was just truly in the moment, feeling the song. Yes. C5, are there any performances you wish you could do over? Josh, Until I Found You from Hollywood Week, I wish I had 3 days to learn that song. C5, how would you say being on American Idol changed your life? Josh, I don't know how to describe it because it's such a significant change, honestly. It put me into a position where I could rapidly grow, rapidly learn, just push myself to my limits in a very short amount of time. On top of that, it's also giving me the opportunity to meet everyone I did, contestants and crew alike. As it thins out and it gets narrowed down, you either really have to kind of lock in on it, and that's all you think about or you know. It just gets harder. It's not because the workload gets hard. It's just that it gets quiet and lonely very fast. It just gets very quiet, and I'm a very social person, and I get my energy from other people around me and just having fun with them. And so it definitely got a bit harder for me as the weeks progressed because of that. It definitely changed my life because it's given me the opportunity just to be a part of it. And that's my biggest takeaway from it, is that I got to be a part of this. Let's see. And then the last question we're going to cover, C5. How does the idle stage compare to singing in public to strangers in an airport? Something you mentioned you've done several times as a volunteer pianist at Charlotte Douglas before going on the show. Josh, one, you're playing for people that are not really there to see music. They're just passing through. You're just background noise. They're not there to see you. You are, as I like to say, just a background character. Whereas you're on American Idol, suddenly people are there to watch what you do. They want to see what you pull out next, and they watch your journey from the very beginning to see how the judges and the show challenge you and how you will ride to those challenges. Rehearsing on stage without a crowd is way different than actually performing on the stage with a crowd. The crowd completely changes everything, and it changes the energy. It really changes it, and it changes it in a good way, and so none of my rehearsals were ever like the way I performed my songs. And now our next article will be read by Mary Ellen.
All right, we're going to go in a completely different direction. We're going to start looking at U.S. and world news. Pope Leo XIV celebrates the first Mass of his papacy in Vatican's Sistine Chapel. Pope Leo XIV held the first Mass of his papacy Friday morning in the Vatican's Sistine Chapel with the cardinals who elected him leader of the world's 1.4 billion Catholics and Vatican head of state a little more than 12 hours earlier. Speaking initially in English, Chicago-born Leo, whose real name is Robert Prevost, thanked the assembled cardinals for placing their trust in him in the 90-minute service, in which he also acknowledged the practical side of his role as administrator of the church. My brother cardinals, as we celebrate this morning, I invite you to reflect on the marvels the Lord has done, the blessings that the Lord continues to pour out on all of us through the ministry of Peter. You have called me to carry that cross and to carry out that mission, and I know I can rely on each and every one of you to walk with me as we continue as a church, as a community of friends of Jesus, as believers, to announce the good news, to announce the gospel, he said, before reverting to Italian for his homily based around the first pope, St. Peter. Leo said his election as the 267th pope yesterday afternoon was God calling him to succeed Peter, and that God has entrusted this treasure to me so that, with his help, I may be its faithful administrator for the sake of the entire mystical body of the church. In a nod to his predecessor, Pope Francis, Leo urged humility, calling on all in the church to move aside so that Christ may remain, to make oneself small so that he may be known and glorified. He said missionary outreach was needed more than ever to compete with the draw of technology, riches, and pleasure, and in a world where it was becoming harder for the church's message to be heard with believers mocked, opposed, despised, or at best tolerated and pitied. Even today, there are many settings in which the Christian faith is considered absurd, meant for the weak and unintelligent. Settings where other securities are preferred, like technology, money, success, power, or pleasure, said Leo. Calling on people to imitate the model of human holiness Jesus Christ had shown to the world so many centuries before,
Leo warned that life without faith was life without meaning. Leo, 69, a graduate of Villanova University, a Catholic university just outside Philadelphia, where he earned a bachelor's degree in mathematics, spent much of his career in Peru and is seen as a reformer. Peru celebrated the election of Prevost, a dual U.S.-Peruvian citizen, from President Dina Boluarte on down. However, the BBC reported that he had faced questions in Peru about his handling of sexual abuse allegations against priests while he was Bishop of Chiquelo, after being appointed by Francis in 2014. In 2023, three Peruvian women claimed that Prevost failed to investigate complaints they had lodged about being abused in their teens by two priests in Chiclayo. They said no proper investigation was begun when they took their allegations to the diocese in 2022. Chiclayo diocesan officials insist that action was taken and the priests were suspended while the case was referred to the authorities in the Vatican in charge of dealing with allegations involving serious abuse. The Vatican officials opted not to proceed to a full canonical trial, opting instead to wrap up their investigation after a preliminary inquiry, said the diocese. Like Francis, Prevost was an apparent longtime vocal critic of aspects of U.S. President Donald Trump's presidency, according to CNN, which a social media account in Prevost's name had reposted posts and articles attacking his immigration policies. He sees the United States headed in the wrong direction in terms of immigration, John Prevost, the new Pope's brother, said. In 2020, Leo offered prayers for George Floyd, after he was killed by a Minneapolis police officer and appeared to support the subsequent Black Lives Matter protests, although he urged people to ensure demonstrations did not descend into violence. CNN said it had been unable to independently confirm the account belonged to Prevost or was controlled by his office. Now we'll go back to Lisa.
And I've got another article about the new Pope. An American Pope emerges as a potential contrast to Trump on the world stage. Cardinal Robert Francis Prevost's ascension to the papacy marks an extraordinary moment for American leadership on the world stage at a time when President Donald Trump has transformed the country's reputation abroad and fueled distrust among longtime allies. But while two Americans now sit in positions of enormous global influence, Pope Leo XIV may offer the world a different view of U.S. values from Trump's America First approach, which he has executed through stiff tariffs, imperialist musings, and vast cuts to foreign aid. When he was introduced to the world, the new Pope, who speaks five languages and is a naturalized citizen of Peru, emphasized his pluralistic background, making a point of speaking in Italian, representing his new constituency, and Spanish, his old one. He spoke no English and made no reference to the United States, even as some Catholics in St. Peter's Square excitedly waved U.S. flags. On Friday, he spoke briefly in English when he delivered his first homily. There are indications that the first American pontiff disapproves of some of the Trump administration's hardline stances. A social media account under his name has reported messages critical of the president's positions on issues including immigration, gun control, and climate change. In February, the account shared a link to an article in the National Catholic Reporter titled, J.D. Vance is Wrong. Jesus doesn't ask us to rank our love for others. We have this powerful moral voice that is going to be able to potentially confront the other most powerful American voice, said Charlie Sykes, an anti-Trump conservative who was Catholic. Donald Trump bestrides the world as the ugly American, and now we have another prominent American who was able to confront him. Sykes said Leo's advocacy on behalf of migrants in particular could challenge Trump, who has pursued an aggressive campaign to deport them as quickly as possible. Part of Donald Trump's appeal is that he is the great champion of Christendom, and now he's going to have to explain that to a fellow American who is the Pope, Sykes said. There are very few, if any, figures that have the platform and the voice of the Holy See. John Prevost, the Pope's brother, told the New York Times in an interview that he did not think his brother would shy away from voicing his disagreements with the president. "I know he's not happy with what's going on with immigration," he said. "I know that for a fact. How far he'll go with it is only one's guess, but he won't just sit back. I don't think he'll be the silent one." Still, Vatican analysts say Leo is more reserved than his predecessor, and while they expect him to continue to define migrants and the poor, or I'm sorry, they expect him to continue to defend migrants and the poor, some do not expect him to do so in an outspoken manner as Pope Francis. Trump and his supporters have also found aspects of the new pope's background that excite them, including his ardent anti-abortion advocacy and his opposition to a government plan in Peru to add teachings on gender in schools. He said and done some mixed things in the past, said John Yep, CEO of Catholics for Catholics, a group that supports Trump. "Let's see how he does. I don't want to rush to judgment right off the bat." In the hours since Leo's selection, the president has had only praise for the church's new leader. Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance congratulated him in post on social media and celebrated his American heritage. The president made his reaction to Pope Leo's announcement yesterday very clear. Caroline Leavitt, the White House press secretary, told reporters Friday when asked about the pope's comments, "He's very proud to have an American pope." It is unclear if either Trump or Vance had been aware of Leo's criticism of their policies, but some of the president's most strident supporters have registered their displeasure. "He is anti-Trump, anti-MAGA, pro-open borders, and a total Marxist like Pope Francis," Laura Loomer, the far-right activist who has persuaded Trump to fire some of his aides for not being loyal enough, wrote on the social platform X. "Catholics don't have anything good to look forward to, just another Marxist puppet in the Vatican." Representative Nancy Pelosi, a former House Speaker and a devout Catholic, praised Leo's commitment to the poor and said she hoped he could unite American Catholics across partisan divides. "His values-based vision for the church is quite different from what we're seeing from some leaders, if you call them that, in our country, but I don't expect him to be engaged in a political debate with the President of the United States," she said in an interview. Even though Leo is an American by birth, he has spent most of his adult life outside the country, and now at the head of the state of another nation, it remains to be seen what relationship he will have with the United States. Francis, who hailed from Argentina, never returned to his place of birth after becoming the church's leader. American cardinals said at a news conference Friday that Leo's American identity was not a factor in his selection. When he was announced, the Vatican made no mention of his U.S. nationality, instead introducing him as the second pope from the Americas. Cardinal Wilton Gregory, the Archbishop Emeritus of Washington, D.C., said the conclave was not seen as a continuation of the American election. "It wasn't an election conclave, he said. It was a desire to strengthen the Christian faith among God's people. Joe Donnelly, the U.S. ambassador to the Holy See during the Biden administration, said Leo's selection transcended any nationality, but would also serve to demonstrate American values on the world stage. I think Pope Leo will be a wonderful reflection of America, of Chicago, and all of our hard-working people, Donnelly said. He is a prototype of the American success story, working hard, studying hard, and being kind to others. The cardinal selection of an American pope defied the prevailing belief that the church would not choose a leader from the global superpower. In the days leading up to the conclave, Catholic commentators speculated that Trump's disruption of the global political and economic order made a U.S.-born pope even more unlikely. Indeed, some spectators gathered in St. Peter's Square on Thursday were bewildered with his identity emerged. Un Americano? Said Adam Mokorski, 31, from Poland. The immediate disillusion was not directed at the new pope himself, but appeared to reflect how much Trump has roiled international sentiment toward America. Trump wants to divide, said Francesca Eliseo, 29, a theater producer from Rome. Trump has a negative effect not just on America, but on other countries. Perhaps the idea was to have an intermediary who can save not just the church, but the whole world. Some analysts have positioned that the cardinal selected Leo precisely because of Trump. The president agitated many Catholics, even some of his allies, when he posted an AI-generated image of himself dressed as the Pope after Francis died. The president might well be right to claim credit for the selection, at least in part, given the photo he posted on social media, said Rocco Palmo, a Catholic Church analyst. The choice of Leo is the cardinal's way of saying, this is our process and we decide what is Catholic, not the White House. And now we'll go back to Mary Ellen for our next article.
Judge temporarily blocks Trump plans for mass layoffs and program closures. A federal judge Friday called for a two-week pause in the Trump administration's plans for mass layoffs and program closures, barring two dozen agencies from moving forward with the largest phase of the president's downsizing efforts, which the judge said was illegal without congressional authorization. Of all the lawsuits challenging Donald Trump's vision to dramatically scale back the form and function of the federal government, this one is poised to have the broadest effect. Most of the agencies have yet to announce their downsizing plans, but employees across the government have been anxiously waiting for announcements that have been expected for weeks. Ruling just hours after an emergency hearing Friday, Judge Susan Ilston of the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California said the government's effort to lay off workers and shut down offices and programs created an urgent threat to scores of critical services. Congress set up a specific process for the federal government to reorganize itself. The unions and organizations behind the lawsuit have argued that the president does not have the authority to make those decisions without the legislative branch. Ilston noted that process requires consultation with Congress on any plan to abolish or transfer part of an agency. It is the prerogative of presidents to pursue new policy priorities and to imprint their stamp on the federal government, she wrote in a 42-page order. But to make large-scale overhauls of federal agencies, any president must enlist the help of his co-equal branch and partner, the Congress. Ilston listed services that could disappear if the offices that administer them were wiped out, including disaster relief funds for farmers after a flood, in-person appointments for Social Security recipients to discuss their benefits, workplace safety inspections in mines, and grants that support kindergarten programs. The scenario evoked what already happened at the Department of Health and Human Services, when mass layoffs caused major disruptions to programs, but on a larger scale. The deep cuts there indirectly hampered programs, such as one that helps low-income families afford heating bills, and another that helps states track rates of chronic disease and gun violence. Although unions and other organizations have sued the federal government over other personnel actions, including indiscriminately firing thousands of probationary workers earlier this year, this is the first time such a broad coalition came together to challenge the administration's actions. The plaintiffs in the ambitious lawsuit included labor unions, nonprofits, and six cities and counties, including Baltimore, Chicago, San Francisco, and Harris County, Texas, home to Houston. The Trump administration's unlawful attempt to reorganize the federal government has thrown agencies into chaos, disrupting critical services provided across our nation, the coalition said in a joint statement. Each of us represents communities deeply invested in the efficiency of the federal government. Laying off federal employees and reorganizing government functions haphazardly does not achieve that. The lawsuit, filed last week, is the latest in a progression of challenges that have all focused on the erosion of the federal civil service since Trump took office. It chronicled a steady effort to gut agencies in recent months, which it said has harmed not only tens of thousands of federal workers and their families, but the residents of the cities and counties involved, as critical health services, veterans benefits, environmental protections, and disaster relief assistance have lapsed or been thrown into doubt. At particular issue are the looming reductions in force, which represent the biggest piece of Trump's government downsizing efforts. Earlier this year, his administration fired thousands of probationary employees, but the current phase is expected to cut hundreds of thousands. Agencies were given guidance and a brief timeline to complete plans for this reorganization earlier this year. The government has done reorganizations this way before, but never on such a huge scale and on such a short timeline. By April 14th, agencies were to send their final plans to the Office of Personnel Management and the Office of Management and Budget, which were providing guidance. Some agencies announced initial layoffs even before the deadline. The Department of Health and Human Services, for example, fired 10,000 employees in early April. In some cases, it shuttered entire offices and shut down programs. Employees were placed on administrative leave and locked out of their equipment immediately. Employees at other agencies have been dreading the upcoming announcements and have received minimal information about who will be affected. In order to meet the White House's demands for cuts, some agencies have been offering resignation incentives, which are being reviewed and processed. The additional reductions in force will be decided after agency leaders have a better sense of where there are vacancies after the pressured resignations and early retirements. To supplement the lawsuit, lawyers filed about 1,300 pages of sworn statements from local health providers, housing inspectors, law enforcement and firefighters, and others documenting the ways cuts to federal government have impacted their life and work. During Friday's hearing, Eric Hamilton, an attorney from the Justice Department, contended that the coalition of groups behind the lawsuit was legally problematic, because the unionized workers facing layoffs and the nonprofits and local governments bearing the brunt of federal services being cut were in separate categories with obviously distinct harms. Hamilton added that Trump's power to reorganize federal agencies is expansive and that the executive orders he had signed mandating changes were generally beyond the authority of the court to review. Danielle Leonard, a lawyer representing the groups that sued, said the Trump administration's vision was to fundamentally degrade the services that Congress funds agencies to carry out, raising a profound separation of powers conflict as Congress set up a specific process for the federal government to reorganize itself. There's a presumption of regularity that used to exist with respect to the government's actions that I think they need to re-earn, she said. Leonard said the Trump administration has never been able to point to any specific authority through which the president could seize that power from Congress. And she said that the government has consistently offered competing and contradictory explanations of why Trump can authorize the massive restructuring without Congress. It's an Ouroboros, the snake eating its tail, she said.
And the next article I have for you is titled, Tufts student arrested by ICE is released from detention. Rumeysa Ozturk, a Tufts University student, was released from immigration detention Friday after a federal judge said her continued detention could potentially chill the speech of the millions and millions of individuals in this country who are not citizens. At a hearing in U.S. District Court in Vermont, Judge William K. Sessions III said Ozturk should be freed immediately. Her continued detention cannot stand. Ozturk, a doctoral student from Turkey, had been held at the Immigration Detention Center in Basile, Louisiana, for 6 weeks. Her lawyer said she was expected to return home to Massachusetts on Saturday. There was a delay in Ozturk's release Friday as federal officials sought to outfit her with an ankle monitor. The move prompted Sessions to issue a second order Friday afternoon, clarifying that she was to be released immediately without any form of monitoring device. Ozturk, he wrote, was not subject to any travel restrictions. She was released around 5:15 Central Time. On March 25th, Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents in mask and plain clothes had surrounded Ozturk outside her home in Somerville, Massachusetts, while she was on the phone with her mother. She was put on a plane to a detention center in Louisiana, and her friends, family, and lawyers didn't know where she was for 24 hours, they said. Her arrest led to public outrage at her treatment and criticism that the government is abusing the immigration system to deport international students in the guise of combating anti-Semitism. In seeking her release, her lawyers have accused the government of detaining her in retaliation for speech that is protected by the First Amendment. The main evidence against her appears to be an essay critical of Israel that she helped to write in a Tufts students newspaper last year. They also said the conditions at the detention center were exacerbating her chronic asthma and preventing her from carrying out her academic work. Her lawyer, Masa Kababe, said she was relieved and ecstatic that Ozturk had been released. When did speaking up against oppression become a crime? Kababe asked. When did speaking up against genocide becoming something to be imprisoned for? Ozturk appeared at the hearing Friday by a remote feed from the detention center to the courtroom in Burlington, Vermont. Ozturk, who is Muslim, wore a headscarf and an orange coverall. A little over an hour into the hearing, she appeared to suffer an asthma attack, coughing and choking, and the judge allowed her to leave the feed for a while. Ozturk testified that she had experienced escalating asthma attacks since her arrest. The first attack came when the plane that was taking her from Vermont to Louisiana stopped in Atlanta, she said. A pulmonologist, Dr. Jessica McCannon, testified that Ozturk's asthma was poorly controlled in detention and would continue to get worse if she were not released. She said that she had not been able to physically examine Ozturk, but had spoken to her and reviewed her medical records. The hearing had been expedited by Sessions. Earlier this week, a federal appeals court ordered that she be transferred to Vermont by next week to attend a bail hearing. But Sessions decided to hold the hearing with Ozturk still in Louisiana. The hearing was held in Vermont because Ozturk had spent the night there in the custody of federal agents on the way to Louisiana on a circuitous route that her lawyer said had prevented them from finding her. Government lawyers in the appeals court hearing declined to discuss questions about speech raised by another judge, but Sessions did not mince words on Friday, suggesting the government was trying to deport Ozturk based on the slenderest of evidence that she had posed a threat to U.S. foreign policy interests. There has been no evidence that has been introduced by the government other than the op-ed, he said, in granting her release. He added that non-citizens may now avoid exercising their First Amendment rights for fear of being whisked away to a detention center from their home. Department of Homeland Security officials have said that Ozturk had engaged in activities in support of Hamas, a foreign terrorist organization that relishes the killing of Americans. And following her arrest, Secretary of State Marco Rubio commented on Ozturk's detention at a news conference, saying that she had not been given a visa to become a social activist that tears up our university campuses. But during the hearing Friday, the government's lawyer, Michael Drescher, called no witnesses and hardly spoke. When he did speak, it was mainly to raise technical issues about the conditions of her bail. Drescher asked the judge to bear in mind that even though Ozturk was being released from immigration custody, the deportation process against her would continue in an immigration court. Sessions said Ozturk was free to return home. He said he did not see any risk that she would flee. She's also free to travel to Massachusetts and Vermont as she sees fit for further court appearances, he added. The judge said he wanted to give Ozturk maximum mobility so she could pursue the educational opportunities that she needed to complete her doctorate. Ozturk testified that she had been confined with 23 other women in a space intended for 14 people. Stress and the smells of cleaning supplies had exacerbated her asthma, she said. But when she sought treatment, the medical staff at the detention center had been condescending and had raised their voices at her, she said, and a nurse had ripped off her headscarf. She testified that it was impossible to work on her dissertation in detention because she did not have access to her computer, professors, library, or peers. Ozturk, who specializes in children's media, is due to finish her doctoral dissertation in December and to obtain her degree in February, according to the testimony. Her advisor, Sarah Johnson, testified that Ozturk had been doing innovative research on how adolescents use social media to benefit other people. In describing her ties to the Tufts community, Ozturk said she had helped organize an event with colleagues where community members came together to express grief for children in conflict areas around the world, from Gaza to Israel, from Russia to Ukraine, from Congo to Haiti, from Sudan to Yemen, from Cameroon to Afghanistan, from all parts of the world. The judge's decision was another defeat for the government's efforts to deport international students associated with pro-Palestinian advocacy. A week ago, a different federal judge in Vermont, Jeffrey W. Crawford, ordered the release of Mohsen Mahdawi, a Columbia University student, from detention on bail. Mahdawi is a permanent resident of the United States and is about to graduate from Columbia in May. And it looks like that is all the time that we have for our reading today. It's time now for today's feature programs, Ladies Magazine at 11 and Music Review at 11:30. Stay tuned for the Spanish broadcast of Que Pasa at noon, followed by the Triangle Business Journal at 1 p.m. You are listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Lisa Maxwell
and Mary Ellen Sura
have been reading from the NNO. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after this broadcast by visiting our website, www.ncreadingservice.org.